From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. President Obama met with congressional Democrats and Republicans this afternoon to talk about reducing the federal budget deficit. Mr. Obama has endorsed a plan from the Senate's bipartisan Gang of Six. It would take nearly $4 trillion off the debt over the next 10 years.
The major credit rating agencies have been sounding the alarm, warning that the government needs at least that level of cuts to preserve its top-notch bond rating. As NPR Scott Horsley reports, it's a powerful message from the ratings agencies, which were largely discredited in the years leading up to the financial crisis.
A credit rating is a kind of report card that tells investors how likely they are to be repaid when they lend money to a corporation or the government. Nicola Swan develops those report cards for one of the big rating agencies, Standard & Poor's. Because Swan rates government bonds, he has to count not just dollars in the Treasury, but also votes in the House and Senate.
We do have to take into account the politics. The fact is, a very large number of sovereign defaults that have happened have been directly driven by the politics.
Last week, S&P and its ratings rival Moody's both issued warnings that the U.S. government's rock-solid guarantee of repayment might not be so rock-solid after all. Both cited the possibility that lawmakers will not vote to raise the government's debt limit in time to avoid a default. But Swan says that's not his biggest concern. He says the real danger is that after all this talk about getting the government's fiscal house in order, policymakers won't grab the opportunity to make tough, long-term decisions to rein in the deficit.
So if that consensus cannot be reached under these conditions, it does bring up the question of what conditions could they be reached under.
That assessment has strengthened the hand of people in both parties who are pushing for large-scale deficit reduction. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner invoked the rating agencies during closed-door negotiations at the White House last week. And Texas Congressman Jeb Hensarling quoted from a ratings report during a Republican news conference.
Rough translation, there is no more road left to kick the can down the road.
S&P does not take a position on what mix of spending cuts or tax increases might achieve its deficit-cutting target. But Swan says in order for any plan to be believable, it will have to survive through several different election cycles.
So for that to happen, we believe you would have to have the leadership of both parties agree to the plan.
That suggests that the plan can't be tilted too much one way or another.
Well, it has to be a compromise.
In a sense, the rating agencies are merely stating the obvious. But the obvious carries extra weight when they say it. Amy Boris, who's with the Council of Institutional Investors, can only shake her head at the attention paid to the rating agencies, given their track record over the last decade.
It's been, in a word, pretty poor. You know, 10 years ago, they failed to see the collapse of Enron coming around the corner. In the global financial crisis, there were many instances where credit raters inflated ratings on structured financial products to win business from firms that issued the debt.
That's been one of the problems with rating agencies. They're typically paid by the companies or governments whose debt they're rating, a system that's been likened to having food critics paid by the restaurants they're reviewing. Bob Danhauser, who's with a professional group of investment pros called the CFA Institute, says one of the goals of the Dodd-Frank financial overhaul was to limit the influence of rating agencies as the sole arbiters of creditworthiness.
They're unusual in Washington these days in that nobody likes them. Nobody's standing up for them. They're sort of a universally disliked target. And that was heard loud and clear as Dodd-Frank got negotiated and passed.
So far, though, no clear alternative to the rating agencies has emerged. And Danhauser thinks in the current debate over deficits, they're actually performing a valuable service.
One of the criticisms of credit rating agencies is that they're always a little bit late to the party. This is a pretty good example, I think, of them trying to be in front of the issue and say, here's the path that we're on and look out.
S&P Swan says that warning is really directed at investors, not the government. But as U.S. policymakers decide what to do next, some will be thinking about how this will look on the country's financial report card. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Members of Congress are trying mightily to prevent what many experts say will be another crisis if the nation's debt ceiling isn't raised, and top executives at major companies are leaning heavily on them to strike a deal. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, the economic stakes are high, especially for the housing market.
Right now, interest rates are low, and that means that the government can borrow money cheaply to finance its huge debt load. Likewise, many home buyers can get low mortgage rates, and that's been a rare bright spot for the beaten-down housing market.
Rates are unbelievable. I think it's one thing that's kept the market really from being in much worse shape.
Patrick Fortin runs Century 21 Commonwealth. It has 500 real estate agents and 18 offices around Boston. He's walking out the back door of a house that's for sale in the town of Winchester.
A really nice yard.
Yeah, you could have a swing set and still have room for a patio, barbecue.
Hockey rink now. Everyone in Boston's building hockey rinks, so that's going to be the craze with the Bruins.
Fortin's been watching the ongoing political fight over the debt ceiling, and he thinks it's hurting the housing market and other industries already because he thinks lawmakers are making Americans nervous about the economy.
I'd like to see them get it done and work it out and move on. You know, that whether you're selling cars or hamburgers or houses, when people are concerned that we could have, you know, major economic issues, it impacts everything. Buyers don't want to buy if they think there's bigger issues out there.
Many economists agree that consumer confidence is taking a hit from all this. Their other big concern is that investors have been starting to get nervous, too. And it's possible that that could end up driving interest rates higher, which would not be good at all for Fortin's mortgage business.
Oh, there's no question. Any sort of bump is an impact. A substantive bump would be dramatic.
Okay, so here's how this would work. If the debt ceiling isn't raised, the U.S. Treasury could default on its debts. Treasury says it would run out of money that it needs to make payments on some of its Treasury bonds.
Treasuries are essentially the holy of all holy credits.
Scott Simon is one of the top bond investors at PIMCO, which manages more than $1 trillion on behalf of pension funds and other customers. He says financial markets are based on trust, and investors around the world have tremendous faith in U.S. Treasury bonds. So
if the U.S. defaults or appears like it's going to default intentionally, I think that puts huge question into the credibility, the sanctity, the holiness of U.S. Treasuries.
And that means that investors could demand higher interest rates to loan the U.S. government money. But it could also drive up interest rates for all kinds of other things, including home loans. Simon explains that U.S. lawmakers even just flirting with default, as they've been doing, that's already raising some scary questions in the investing world. If treasuries might not be sacred, well, then what about home loans that are guaranteed by the government-backed mortgage firms Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Those are probably less sacred. And what if the U.S. someday doesn't honor those guarantees?
There is a worry, and you see it in the patterns of international investors, that they've started to shy away from Fannie and Freddie mortgages in spite of the explicit support of the government.
If more investors lose faith, Simon believes that that would push interest rates way up and severely restrict millions of Americans' ability to qualify for loans.
We think housing is fragile, very, very easy to break, and very, very difficult to fix it if you break it. And, you know, I think my biggest personal fear is that the Congress, in trying to get a good headline, accidentally breaks the housing market, and you want to avoid that desperately.
Simon thinks another crash in housing could bring the whole banking system down with it. An actual default on Treasury bonds could be even worse. And this is why many top business people are putting pressure on politicians to basically stop the madness and raise the debt ceiling. Many think lawmakers are playing a dangerous game that could push up interest rates. And if that happens,
it's going to have a staggering impact on the economy.
Richard Smith is the CEO of Realogy Corporation, which owns Century 21 and Coldwell Banker and other firms. He says he's on the phone every day to his lobbyists in Washington who are pushing lawmakers to reach a deal. He says many other CEOs are doing the same.
Running up to the very last minute is just completely irresponsible on the part of the government. To take the entire business community to the edge, what do you think is going to happen? Nothing. People are not investing. They're not making major business decisions. They're not hiring. They're holding their cards.
So investors and CEOs are hoping Congress pushes a deal through quickly. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
We're going to focus now on one of the many deficit reduction measures currently being debated by lawmakers. It involves changing the way federal benefits and certain provisions of the tax code are adjusted for inflation. The proposal: stop using the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, and start using something called the chained CPI. Robert Greenstein is executive director of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. He joins me now to do some heavy lifting here for us, to help us understand something that can be quite difficult to understand. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Could you, in one sense, explain to us exactly what the CPI is and how a chain CPI is different from a regular CPI?
The regular CPI measures the costs each month of a market basket of items that average Americans may purchase each month. And so it tells us how much prices are rising, what the inflation rate is. The chain CPI is identical, really, to the regular CPI in all respects except one. It includes an adjustment so that if, for example, beef prices rise much faster than chicken prices, and consumers, as a result, buy less beef and more chicken, it picks up the switching from the beef to the chicken, which makes their total costs for the month rise a little less quickly than if you assumed they continued to buy the same amount of beef and the same amount of chicken as before.
So how would having a fuller and more accurate set of adjustments help the government save money?
It helps the government save money in two ways. All programs that provide an annual cost of living adjustment in their benefits, from Social Security to federal retirement programs, some veterans programs, they would now have their benefits adjusted from year to year by using the chain CPI, and on average, benefits would rise about 0.25 percentage point more slowly per year.
So if it brings in a little less in benefits, or if it doles out a little less in benefits, let's take a benefit that people might have an easy time understanding. How big a cut, for instance, in a Social Security benefit might we be talking about?
Well, let's see. So if you had a $1,000 a month Social Security check, instead of someone's $1,000 a month check going to $1,030, it goes to $1,027.50. I think the nub of the issue is the following. Analysts agree that overall, the chain CPI is a more accurate measure of inflation than the regular CPI, and whether it's in Social Security or any other program or in the tax code, we should adjust for inflation. We shouldn't over-adjust.
If using the chain CPI is such an easy way to save money, potentially savings of up to $500 billion over 10 years, why are they just talking about this switch now? Why isn't this something that has been debated or even adopted earlier?
This is a very controversial change. You can view it as this is not a benefit cut, this is not a tax increase. We say we want to adjust for inflation, let's use the most accurate measure of inflation. Or you can say, well, relative to current law, this would be lower benefits in Social Security and higher taxes. So it either looks non-controversial or it touches all the third rails at the same time.
Robert Greenstein is executive director of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Mr. Greenstein, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.